Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions and emails, all in the next hour here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, last week we had a lot of discussion about smart meters, and the debate goes on. And thanks to those people who contributed and continue to contribute to the dialogue, and I have a number of references from readers to go look up, and if anything substantially changes in my summary from last week, I'll be sure to let you know. In the short run, I think our, just to recap, our conclusions are the big issue, if there is an issue, is probably related to keeping your cell phone glued to your ear. So headsets, particularly wired headsets, are the real precautionary principle approach. So if you're worried about RF, the biggest potential danger, and we're not sure how big a danger it is sitting in your pocket. We're going to answer some emails today. This first one from Judith in Atlanta. Competing supplements. I take fish oil and evening primrose oil. I've read these products fight for the same receptors and therefore shouldn't be taken together. If that's true, can I take one in the morning and one at night, or should I take them every other day? I appreciate your show and appreciate you address the practical issues in a way we can make them work in real life. Well, Judith, in terms of receptors for free fatty acids, that's not really how oils are absorbed. Oils are actually mostly absorbed as little tiny, well, bubbles, if you will. And that's one of the things that bile does, is it acts as a detergent to help dissolve the fish oils, as well as any other oil you might eat, down to these tiny little micelles, they're called, and they go into your bloodstream after eating through a passive diffusion process. So I don't think that that kind of receptor is the issue. And in terms of what happens to those omega-3 and omega-6 oils once they get into your bloodstream, they're used to manufacture a host of things, cell membranes, for one, and also the prostaglandins, and that's through something called the arachidonic acid pathway. Bottom line on that is that omega-6 oils tend to make a stronger inflammatory mediator than omega-3 oils, and it turns out that omega-3 oil inflammatory mediator is probably what we were evolved to make, but since Paleolithic times, our diet has changed, and as a result, our systems have actually become more inflamed, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, I don't think that you need to separate your dosing, and I don't think you need to worry about the timing of your evening primrose oil. Evening primrose oil has gamma-linoleic acid in it, and that is a good omega-6 and something that we do all need. So most people say, yes, if you're going to take high-dose long-term omega-3s, you should probably throw in some GLA. Maybe about half as much GLA as EPA is the ratio that I've been taught is the right one, and I am totally not sure how science-based that recommendation is. This one from Christine in Albuquerque. I wonder if you saw this article and wanted to comment on it. And it's a New York Times article talking about how a European study recently published failed to show a benefit for mammograms. It was an epidemiologic study. And I won't go into the details except to say that yet one more piece of controversial literature. Some say it helps, some say it doesn't, some say mammograms prolong life. Some say, well, if you control for lead time bias, which is to say it looks like they're living longer because you're diagnosing it earlier, then you can't show a difference. There are so many variables there that I think epidemiology studies can be massaged in either direction. I think it's also pretty clear that mammograms don't cause harm, at least in terms of what the epidemiologic studies show. After my last mammogram, I had to have a cyst drain, continues Christine. It was a major hassle for various reasons and really expensive for a person with high deductible insurance in our second-rate medical system. When I asked what caused them, the doctor said age, which suggests this might be a regular thing. When I complained about it to a friend, she said, oh yeah, happens every year to me. I don't do anything about them anymore, just wait and watch. What do you think about this strategy? I am in favor of watchful waiting for breast cysts. I think that's a completely appropriate strategy. And the idea with this is that when people are going through perimenopause and sometimes later when they're on hormone replacement therapy, but also when they're having regular periods, there are fluctuations in hormone levels. Estrogen is a growth hormone for the breasts. And so people will develop cysts or fluid-filled balls, basically little balloons filled with fluid in the breast, as long as an ultrasound shows that the cyst is without any internal components, it's just fluid, it's perfectly fine to watch those. If they're palpable, they're easy to aspirate, and that can be done in the doctor's office, but it's not critical as long as you monitor them and they're not growing or developing suspicious inclusions in the center. Watchful waiting is just fine for breast cysts. I do want to throw out there that anyone who's having problems with breast cysts or lumpy tender breasts for that matter probably needs to try taking extra iodine. Breasts have an enormous number of receptors for iodine, second only in fact to the thyroid gland. And in natural medicine circles, there's a strong lore that use of iodine reduces painful tender breasts and reduces the production of breast cysts. There is literature behind that. And the dosing, well, the dosing's all over the map, but you're probably safe taking 5 milligrams of iodine daily. And I want to point out that the RDA for iodine to prevent a goiter is 150 micrograms. So that's the amount you need not to get a goiter. And the amount not to have a deficiency disease is not necessarily the amount that you actually need for health. So I wanted to emphasize that point especially. Let's go to this email from Helen in Carmel. Diverticulitis. A month ago, I went to a doctor with pain in the left side of my pelvis, bowel irregularity, bloating, and gas. She guessed diverticulitis and prescribed Cipro and Flagyl both for 10 days. I'm on day 8 and still uncomfortable. Question. I'm a 72-year-old, very healthy female, not obese, walk my dogs on the beach 30 minutes every day, no beef or pork, many meatless meals, some fish and chicken, lots of green salad and vegetables. After reading on this subject, I'm stumped to why I have this condition. Besides my age, any conflicting advice? High fiber, low fiber? Rest, exercise, food grouping, and thanks very much for your opinion. Okay, so first of all, I want to emphasize that Helen's diagnosis is not a fully established diagnosis, and the fact that she did not get better after 10 days on antibiotic, in my mind, calls into question the diagnosis of diverticulitis in the first place. Other issues, perhaps a parasite, a infestation with a pathogenic bacteria, Giardia, these are other things that kind of rise up in my mind. And yes, indeed, we do have parasites in the United States, even though we have indoor plumbing. So in terms of if she has diverticulitis, you would find that out by a colonoscopy or a barium enema, which would show these characteristic outpouchings in the lower intestine, which are called diverticula. And those can occur in anybody. They are associated with age, wear and tear, effectively. They're strongly associated with constipation, and there's a strong family history component. I have seen diverticula in people in their 20s, but almost invariably in that circumstance, there's a family history of diverticulitis, and there's probably a familial mutation in one of the structural proteins that builds the bowel that leads to an increased vulnerability to this condition. In general, a high-fiber diet prevents diverticulitis. When a person is suffering from an acute attack, we recommend a low residue diet simply for bowel rest. But then as soon as they've recovered from this problem, they should be on lots of fiber, particularly soluble fiber like oat bran, to prevent a recurrence of the condition. Exercise is helpful. lots of fluid, again, preventing the constipation, which allows for increased pressure in the intestine, and that increased pressure pushes against the wall, and if the wall is weak, you get an outpouching of the wall, and that's our cognitive model for how this condition develops. In terms of food groupings, I'm extremely dubious about food grouping. I've looked at the literature on this, and it's almost all anecdotal. There's really nothing to suggest that certain foods eaten together create problems. And if anyone has actual good scientific data and they want to shoot me a reference, I'm happy to look at it. But my searches have failed to turn up anything on the subject. I'm going to go to Pete in Seaside. 2 weeks ago, I rode my bike 200 miles between Seattle to Portland. Wow. My left ankle became swollen after that ride, and it persisted for several days, so I went to my doctor. My left foot was hit about 4 years ago in the heel by a stingray. It was a clean cut across the heel, so I don't know if this earlier injury would have any bearing. My doctor asked me a number of questions about tingling or numbness in the foot, as well as shortness of breath, none of which I have experienced. He later disclosed that these questions were designed to determine if the swelling could be caused by a blood clot. Since I did not seem to have any other symptoms indicating a blood clot, he then prescribed 800 milligrams of ibuprofen, one with each meal. After 4 days of this, the swelling has gone down by about 40%, but has not gone away altogether, and he wants me to get an ultrasound because he's still concerned about blood clots. My question is, if the swelling was caused by a blood clot, wouldn't it have caused much more serious problems by now? That's 2 whole weeks later. Well, first of all, when people exercise a lot, extremely, they can cause microtrauma in the vasculature, and that can actually lead to the formation of a thrombus or blood clot inside the veins. Another thing that can do that is inactivity. So, ironically, extremes in both directions are associated with this problem, although it's much more common in inactivity, long airplane flights and such. Once the blood clot forms, if it is a big one, it will cause swelling, well, downstream, basically, or I should say upstream in the foot, that side will get larger, and it'll tend to be a diffuse swelling. There's also often tenderness and inflammation at the site of the clot, so people will complain of pain in the calf, and sometimes there'll even be redness of the skin and a palpable area of tenderness. Now, this is true for superficial as well as deep clots, but the superficial clots are not dangerous, while the deep clots, at least potentially, can break off and spread to the lungs, and in some individuals who have a hole in their heart, actually cross the heart and cause strokes. I've seen that happen in people with patent foramen ovale and other sorts of cardiac conditions. But in general, it's the lungs that are going to be the first capillary bed to strain out that clot, and so better to lose a few lung cells than a few brain cells. However, a massive clot can actually kill you. Because you have something that's not responding exactly like a sore joint, your doctor wanted to get an ultrasound to be sure, and some of that's defensive medicine, and some of that's also genuine what will kill the patient concern about a condition that isn't quite following its normal pattern. So the answer to the question is, I'm kind of side with your doctor on this one. I think you should get the ultrasound. I think you probably will have a negative ultrasound. And it's just one more reason to emphasize the importance of people having good health insurance or having a health insurance system where everyone is covered, where there's not a large financial cost to the patient to do these sorts of due diligence procedures. When people start worrying about getting a test because it's going to cost them too much money and they want to be sure they really need the test, we start to get into a type 1 or a type 2 error situation. Do you want to be healthy until proven sick or sick until proven healthy? And which is the one that's going to lead to the least morbidity and mortality? Well, that's a point we could debate. Time for news stories now. This first one was a recent report. This is researchers at the University of Washington who are interested in figuring out exactly how much would it cost to eat healthily. So people who spend the least amount of money on their food spend $6.77 a day. That's the lowest quartile in this study. Those people were, not too surprisingly, they're the farthest from hitting the government's daily guidelines for potassium, fiber, vitamin D, calcium, and they are overshooting the calories for fats and sugar. Well, no surprises there. If you spend your time eating at fast food restaurants, which is absolutely the cheapest way to survive, then you will end up falling short nutritionally. But what the researchers did was quite funny. They decided to cost it out. So they surveyed about 1,000 and change people in the Seattle area, took information about age, household income, educational diet, and detailed questionnaires for eating habits. And then they basically went shopping. And in this case of this published study, they were looking at potassium. The average gap in what is recommended for potassium is 700 milligrams. So we are all falling short of potassium by 700 milligrams. And the concept here is that if you were to try and fill that by eating rather than taking supplements, it would cost you $1 a day or $380 a year. And of course, if you add fat and sugar, you decrease the food cost. We've already talked about that. The question is there a way that we could socially engineer our farming subsidies such that fruits and vegetables, which contain high levels of potassium, would be more available? And, you know, the best dietary sources of potassium are relatively inexpensive, if somewhat starchy, fruits and vegetables. And those are bananas and potatoes. So both of these are excellent sources of potassium. Sea salt contains some potassium, but not necessarily as much iodine as I'd like. So by the way, we were talking about iodine earlier in the reference to the fibrocystic breasts. If you have a diet that is exclusively sea salt and you don't get a lot of iodized salt, you may need to add extra iodine on general principle. Maintenance iodine, according to the minimum daily requirement, again, is 150 micrograms. I think a couple of milligrams is probably a safe and healthy dose. And that definitely requires supplementation because iodine is depleted, naturally depleted, by the way, in the soil of the United States. And up until the 1930s, when they started adding iodine to the salt, people were eating off the land back then, by the way, and not so much fast and processed food. Goiters were a real problem. Epidemic goiters, in fact, in some parts of the country, which is an enlargement of the thyroid, which occurs when there is a problem with iodine. Moving on in the news, a really interesting research project using let's start with the fact that when tissues are starved of oxygen, they naturally produce a compound called vascular endothelial growth factor. This is why if we have someone, for example, with peripheral artery disease, and we tell them, okay, we want you to go ahead and walk a little bit every day, walk to the point of pain, and then walk again to the point of pain and keep doing it, you know, for an hour every day. What happens physiologically in that individual is that each time the tissue becomes ischemic and starts to hurt, it triggers genetic transcription of vascular epithelial growth factor, which then triggers transcription of the structural material needed for new blood vessels to form. Now, cancers know how to hijack this VEGF, and in fact, this is one of the critical mutations which occurs when something is precancerous on the way to becoming an actual cancer, which can spread and kill you. It has to relearn or develop the ability to unlock the DNA to make vascular epithelial growth factor. And this is important because this is never really truly turned off. It's just that it's stimulated under situations of ischemia. Well, researchers have tried to make VEGF, and in fact, you can clone it and make it and inject it into the muscles of people who have peripheral artery disease. But the trouble is it doesn't stay there and it has a very short half-life, so it diffuses away. So in a very creative approach, the Department of Chemistry, Materials Science, and Engineering at Northwestern University has developed a novel nanostructure that is basically a nano thread studded with protein particles that mimic vascular epithelial growth factor. And this nano thread is injected as a liquid into the tissue, and it sits there in the tissue, doesn't migrate. And because it has on its surface this protein that mimics VEGF, it acts like a depot injection of VEGF, which isn't possible to do, and stimulates the growth of new blood vessels. This is an extremely creative and interesting approach, and it has been used in animals. The lead researcher is Dr. Stupp, S-T-U-P-P, and Weber. Weber, I guess, is the graduate student, so he got to be the top name on the paper. But anyway, the animal studies used mice whose limbs had been restricted so that they had only 10% of normal blood flow. Then when they were treated with this nanofiber, the blood flow was restored to about 80%, and I don't have the time frame for how long that took, but probably on the order of months. So this is a new and very interesting medical device which might be very, very useful in humans. But when I was talking about VEGF a moment ago, you'll remember I said something about cancers, and I said that cancers need VEGF in order to grow. Well, what about that? What if we put VEGF into people in a local area? Are they, if they have precancers, let's say they have a potential melanoma or a precancerous squamous cell carcinoma in the area of the skin, close enough to that, that they get some diffusion or possibly some increased blood flow to the area. Could we inadvertently trigger cancers with a therapy like this? Yes, it's far-fetched, but it's possible. And the problem is, a device like this falls into a real gray area. Is this a drug or is this a medical device? Well, I'm not sure. You tell me, and I guess it's up to the FDA. Recently, and this is very much in the news, the Institute of Medicine, which is an independent panel of experts, you know, everybody has probably some sort of secondary gain or conflict of interest when you get up to that level, but they are generally felt to be an objective group without ties to industry, which I think is extremely important to listen to what they have to say, because they look at the science, and like myself, they're not being supported by advertising, they're not being, they don't have a job waiting for them in industry such that they wouldn't want to offend somebody. And thus, we hope, can tell the truth as they see it. What this panel said recently was that our current methods used by the FDA to decide that medical devices are safe for the market is completely, completely flawed. And there is no reason to believe that any of the devices on the market are unsafe. On the other hand, our ability to determine if they are safe is absolutely flawed as a process. See, only the very highest risk devices, such as implantable defibrillators or replacement heart valves, ever actually undergo clinical trials prior to approval to show that they are safe and effective. If a device is deemed only moderate risk, the manufacturer can get it cleared, just kind of grandfathered in, if they can show that it's substantially equivalent to previously cleared devices. Those devices may have been cleared themselves because they were substantially equivalent to devices, and those devices may have been junked and replaced. And so ultimately, we've had problems in recent years with things like artificial hips, a synthetic mesh vaginal sling for urinary tract infections had to be pulled. There was a problem with an internal patch for injured knees. And all of these things went through this substantially equivalent pass through the FDA and were then rolled out into the marketplace. And then as data accumulated, were pulled away. Now, maybe that's the only way that we're going to be able to do it. Maybe it's too onerous to require the manufacturers of medical devices to do clinical trials. After all, clinical trials in a device would require a placebo device, which is a great deal more difficult to do than a placebo pill and also a great deal more expensive. Also, until you do something on 10,000 people, the 1 in 1,000 issue is probably not going to be statistically visible. And in the case of 10,000 people, that's way more than the FDA requires even for the approval of a drug. So it's an interesting debate, and I'm sure it will continue. But as we talk about these medical devices, and particularly this new science that I love to bring to you, we have to keep in mind that when do we let the horse out of the barn and actually use this on real-time wild-type humans? And what is our follow-up criteria? I think we could track everyone on Twitter and find out exactly what's going on with them. The level of technology that we've got now might enable us, and I'm being facetious about the Twitter, but I do mean that having registries and having people report, give them a smartphone and track them and let them report and get their permissions to see what their medical bills are and what their doctor's visit are, crunch all that data, and you could probably track these devices and figure out problems fairly early, but we'll still be experimenting on our population. I don't see any way around that. And we're going to Kathleen from Los Angeles. Hello, Kathleen. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm okay, but I've been having a lot of pains. It's usually about 2 weeks before my cycle.
Mid-cycle.
First, I thought it was middle schmerz. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Oh, yes.
But it's too painful for it just to be that. And they've given me two ultrasounds, the one that they do vaginally and the one on the outside. And I don't have insurance, so I have to wait months for my appointments at Harbor UCLA.
Right. That's a county hospital.
Yeah, and I have, well, so my periods are very heavy with clots and everything. Pain, it's almost like back labor. It's so painful. It goes right from it's always on the right side. It's like, it feels like it's in my right ovary, and it goes a stabbing pain right through to my back.
All right. Now, in your ultrasounds, you said you'd had two. In either of them show any fibroids?
They haven't seen any fibroids or anything yet.
All right. And are your periods regular?
They're regular, right? Like clockwork.
Like clockwork, okay. So in terms of it not being middle schmerz because, you know, it hurts too much, I am in total disagreement with that statement. Middle schmerz can hurt as much as labor. But middle schmerz is a German term. It means pain in the middle, meaning pain in the middle of the cycle. And it is ovulation pain. Some people really react to the follicular fluid. They find it highly inflammatory, and it sets off a chain reaction that leads to cramping of the uterus. One of the things that I've used clinically, well, there's two things really. The first one is that of the drugs, for some reason, naproxen, which is sold commercially under the name Aleve, and there's also generics of that, at doses of about 500 milligrams twice a day, which is a medical dose, not a over-the-counter dose, Aleve taken for a couple of days before the ovulation works best. You sort of have to lead with the blocking the prostaglandins. I was talking about that in the context of fish oils earlier at the top of the show, if you caught that. So the idea is that fish oil makes kinder, gentler prostaglandins. You might want to take maybe 4,000 milligrams of fish oil daily in order to get that benefit. And you could do that throughout the month. But on top of that, if you have a regular cycle and you use a calendar, you should be able to figure out pretty much when you're going to ovulate, when that pain's going to hit.
And yeah, I write it down the calendar, and it's exactly the same time every time.
Right. So what you do is you subtract.
And they put me on the pill, too, and they put me on ibuprofen, but it hasn't done anything for the pain.
Naproxen works better, and you need to start it a couple of days before you expect the pain. That's the trick. Once the pain happens, you're dead in the water on this. It's going to loop through and do its thing.
A hysterectomy wouldn't help me in this?
Well, a hysterectomy would remove the uterus and potentially the ovaries. How old are you?
I'm 44, and I don't want to have any, you know, look older than I am already, you know?
Yeah, I understand. Well, a hysterectomy would probably, and I want to emphasize, probably help because your pain is mid-cycle. And you feel it in your back, and you don't have fibroids. So I infer from that it's coming from the uterus. But the concern I have is that after a hysterectomy, you can have adhesions, you can have a change in your potential for orgasms, you can have a loss of bladder control. That's a lot to do. And so I want to leave no stone unturned in my patients before I recommend a surgical solution for pain. That's like a domino effect, all sorts of downstream unintended consequences that you're letting yourself potentially in for. So
I've even tried taking other people's narcotics, and it really hasn't helped that much either, and I don't like the side effects.
Right. Well, we get that you've got pain, and it's severe. How long does it last, by the way? Is it more than a couple of days?
A week, even more, even up to like almost 10 days. It starts 2 weeks before my period, and then the periods are horrible. But the pain before is worse than my actual period pain.
Okay.
I've always had horrible periods, though.
Yeah, well, I think you're one of those people who just has this inflammatory. If you haven't done the high-dose fish oil, go there.
Okay.
As far as the birth control pill is concerned, there are other possibilities, one of which would be to do continuous birth control pills so you don't let yourself have a period.
Yeah, they offered that, and I wanted to try the other form of birth control first because they first had me on one that was just progesterone because I used to smoke cigarettes, but I quit. They didn't want to have me have any estrogen at first.
Right. Right. I understand. Yeah. I think, you know, one of the reasons that they may be pushing you towards the hysterectomy is that, you know, that's quote unquote the definitive solution. Ironically enough, if you have pelvic pain and you're a, you know, Medi-Cal patient, basically.
I don't even have Medi-Cal.
Right. But you're a county patient, effectively,
right,
down there.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for just a solution. And I won't say that their goal is to shut you up. That's not really true. But ironically, if they remove your uterus and you still have pain, you're no longer a gynecological issue because you no longer have a uterus.
Right.
So then you become a chronic pain doctor problem, and essentially they don't have to solve it. And I'm not saying that's their motivation, but, you know, that is in there in the calculus, let's say, that the system makes to itself.
It's been very frustrating getting any answers or even getting appointments.
Well, I believe you. I believe you because essentially everybody's losing money on you.
Right.
We have a really screwed up system and you're falling victim to it. And even if we had a perfect system, if you were in, I don't think Canada's perfect, let's move you to Montreal with this problem, it's still a problem.
Right.
And it still hurts. And you've gotten pretty much state-of-the-art medical approach here.
They think I might have endometriosis.
Well, of course they do, but that's why I'm suggesting the continuous birth control pill.
Okay.
Because if you have endometriosis, the continuous birth control pill will usually at least lower the pain because endometriosis hurts when you're having your period. And yes.
What's the downside of the continuous birth control pill?
There really isn't much of one beyond the actual downside of taking the pills at all. I mean, the original birth control pill was designed as a continuous pill. They couldn't get women to take it because women were so used to having that monthly period to tell them they weren't pregnant. That
well, I have my tubes tied, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that what my point is mm-hmm. that the reason for a period with the birth control pill is a commercial psychological reason for the patients. There's no scientific basis to do
it. Oh, I won't miss the period whatsoever.
Yeah, so you can do the continuous, and there's no scientific reason not to. There's no health benefit to having the withdrawal bleed.
Well, this is great to talk to you.
Well, I'm glad that I've been able to help. That's
really
one of the reasons we
it.
Do this show, is there's a lot of people out there who just can't get a doctor to sit down and have a 5-minute conversation with them.
No, it's been near impossible for
me. Yeah, I know. I did a training at Harbor UCLA many years ago when I was in residency, and it's crazy. You are so overworked and you're so busy and you're just running around like a fireman during brush fire season, you know, putting out one fire, running over here, putting out another fire, running over there, putting out another fire. There's no time for contemplation. And to this day, when I get into a situation in the middle of a flu epidemic or something like that, where I have to work very fast, let's say I have to see 45 patients in an afternoon, I'm going to give more antibiotics. I'm going to be less thoughtful. I'm going to order more diagnostic studies. I'm going to spend more money and I'm going to do more aggressive kind of interventions like hysterectomies, by analogy, simply because I'm too busy to think. And if we keep our doctors too busy to think because we think we're saving money, what we end up doing is spending money on procedures and unnecessary treatments because the doctors feel like they have to do something and they don't have time to think, so you just do something.
Right, like I will be talking to the nurse, and then the nurse will go tell the symptoms to the doctor, and I can hear them talking about me, and I'm not allowed to talk to the doctor.
Yeah, because you might take too much time.
Right.
You know, we all agree, I think, at least all the listeners here, that we have a crazy situation, and I apologize for my codependency with it, but I don't quite have the None of us, as doctors, have the moral courage to just go on strike and walk away and make them fix it, because people will die while we're doing that.
Right.
We're really stuck in a true ethical dilemma, because we're one of the few people who have the power to out the system and force change. But in the forcing of change, we'll actually hurt individuals. And we can't do that.
Well, you gave me some great advice, and I really appreciate your input.
Well, good luck to you. And yeah, I would thank try you. That continuous pill and get the high-dose fish oil going on too, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
So next bit of story in the news. I love this because I'm an old Star Trek fan. And ever since my childhood, I have wanted Bones' tricorder. I have wanted that little device that you held in your hand and waved up and down on someone's body that told you what was wrong with them. We're almost there. My husband has a smartphone app that takes his pulse. It doesn't do it well, but you put your finger over the flash, over the camera, and it throws the light on it and is trying to count pulses by watching the blanching of the flesh. I have very poor circulation to my fingers, so it didn't work on me. And of course, that's when you really need someone's pulse, is when they have low blood pressure. But nevertheless, it is a big step closer to the tricorder, and so is this one. This is called an M-chip. It's a mobile microfluidic chip, and it's currently being tested in Rwanda in conjunction with Columbia Engineering, Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And what they need is just a tiny little finger prick like you might use for a diabetic. And you can do this even on a newborn baby, which is great. You can test for HIV. You can do all kinds of blood diagnostics. So this test, particularly for infectious diseases and parasites and antibodies, is coming soon to a third world country near you. It would particularly be useful where you have the healthcare worker in the village and you've got maybe the drugs being subsidized by the government, but you don't know who to give the drugs to and you don't know if they're working. With small portable devices like this that require no electricity, and they're a yes or no kind of answer, which is important because we're going to be farming these out to village health workers without extensive training. So we need to give them a black, white, go, no go kind of signal, nothing with shades of gray. And that is one of the problems that we have with a lot of our colorimetric studies, which is to say, it's like, there's a little bit of color there. This is antibody testing, and you're looking at that band, and you're going, I'm not sure it's there or not there. Do I score it or not score it? Depends on the light you're in. All sorts of issues. If you want a more thorough discussion of the problems with this kind of technology, I would recommend going to the archives on Ask Dr. Dawn and looking up the interview with Dr. David Wright, an infectious disease specialist that we interviewed about Lyme disease and also other types of infections which go along with Lyme disease. And you'll find that in the archives from the spring. So interesting information on a chip. The other thing that I wanted to emphasize here is that as we really get to the point where we can see things, there's some interesting stuff going on now where they've invented proteins. Well, they've invented these fluorescent molecules that are very, very small. They're nanoparticles, but they fluoresce when shown with a particular light. Now they can attach them to proteins. So we can track what proteins are occurring in a cell, whether they're being upregulated or downregulated. And now they've found a way to attach them to RNA, because it turns out that RNA isn't just the messenger that carries the genetic code from the nucleus out to the ribosomes where it turns into a protein. RNA is actually a critically important control for transcription. In fact, some form or another of ribonucleic acid is probably doing most of the regulating of genomics and proteomics in the cell. And who knew? Now that we can track RNA by making it fluoresce, we'll be able to understand it. So I really predict that our ability to look inside a cell and watch its mechanics has taken a quantum leap. Well, it's just going to be a very, very interesting ride for the next 20 years as I continue to keep you apprised of the medical literature. So stay tuned for that. Let's talk to Tom in Salinas. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the program.
I really respect your opinions and the time you take, but I'm a nurse and I'm burning out.
Oh, tell us about it.
I don't know. I feel like giving up. I used to do all right in the hospital. You know, I knew what I was doing. Everything's cut and dry protocol. But now in the ambulatory care setting, overwhelming. I love the 8-hour days, but you never get caught up. You never do enough. It's getting worse all the time, and you feel helpless sometimes. What do you do? How do you stay in the game?
Well, thank you for presenting that so succinctly. Succinctness is something I have trouble with. What I want to say about that, first of all, is ask a couple of questions of you, and we'll walk through problem solving, okay?
Uh-huh.
How long have you been in the ambulatory care setting, and how long have you been a nurse?
A year and a half in ambulatory care. I've been a nurse, 77.
Okay. And most of that was then in a hospital setting, which
right.
is a completely different flavor of nursing, obviously.
Right.
Because, as you said, in the hospital setting, there's protocols. And as long as you stay in the protocol lane, it's kind of like being in the carpool lane on the freeway. Yeah. Nobody's going to jump in front of you. You can kind
right.
of just relax and cruise. As long as you stay in that lane, you're good. And you've got the lane defined for you, and you've got rules. And I think nurses in, by the way, the hospital setting are now finding themselves overloaded with protocol documentation. So
right.
it's not enough anymore to do it and stay in the lane. You actually have to constantly write a note. Yes, I'm in the lane. Yes,
yeah,
it's
more important.
It's 2:15, I'm in the lane. Yes, it's 2:16, I'm in the lane. And so as a result, you're not really spending much time with the patient because you're too busy charting to prove that you did everything that you're supposed to be doing. And that's just crazy. But it's the kind of top-down middle management, if we want to fix something, we first need to get control of it, thinking
right.
that is destroying American medicine today. What we need is grassroots, bottom-up, team approach, problem-solving, and let the documentation generate itself. As far as I'm concerned, if these computers are so good, then they should be able to track me and my performance and the nurses and their performance and not make me write things down. They should be able to just figure this out.
And that'd be nice.
Well, actually, they are using that, but they're using it in power games rather than using it to improve patient care. It's just, well, don't get me started on that.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of what happens in an ambulatory setting, for one thing, you're never done, as you said. And so you can't focus in terms of where you get your sense of accomplishment. And I want to, for you, make some suggestions because...
Well, that's it exactly. My yeah. sense of accomplishment is disappearing.
Exactly. And you need that to keep going. You've lost it and you need to refine another way to have that sense of accomplishment besides having fixed the person, because you don't fix people in an ambulatory setting. They have chronic diseases. The ones who are coming in who are making it hard for you have chronic diseases. Often they have unstable social resources. Often they have just truly heartbreaking and tragic things going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And you give them energy, you, as well as taking their pulse and their blood pressure and, you know, doing whatever you need to do for your nursing tasks. You're also giving them heart energy, and that's part of nursing. But you can't keep that up without getting something back. Some of the strategies that I use for an ambulatory care setting, these are important. First of all, before you walk into work and before you leave the work setting, you need to do some kind of mental compartmentalization clearing so that you don't take all of the lint, all of the psychic lint that you pick up throughout the day. I think of it as sticky notes, you know. I've got to remember to do that. I've got to remember to do that. I write them on sticky notes.
Right,
by the end
right.
of the day, I look like a sheepdog with all of
right.
these yellow sticky notes.
I got a drawer full of sticky notes at home.
Yeah, and I've got a brain full of sticky notes. And if I don't stop and breathe and do some movement and pull all of those things off, then my entire life is polluted. So compartmentalization and doing some sort of practice, and it can be 5 minutes of deep breathing before and after work so that you keep the stuff at work. One of the other things is when you feel yourself getting depleted, go lock yourself in the bathroom for 5 minutes or whatever and breathe. That little break and the deep breathing and centering type thing in an ambulatory situation is really important. The second thing is you have to remember that the patient is the one with the disease. And so your victory is not to fix the disease. For me, for example, when I can get Mrs. Jones to actually check her blood sugar before breakfast and after one meal a day, that is the goal I have set myself. And if I can get her to do that for a week, then I'm really happy. And I allow myself to be really happy about that. I take a glass half full sort of approach to all of these clinical problems. I also understand, and this is important for you to understand, that you are doing more than you realize just by being present, just by listening to the patient, just by essentially acknowledging them as existing. You have given them a gift. You have done more than you realize. It's a very, very different
set. The patients aren't the problem. It's a system demanding more and more. You know, you take that time to build rapport and build that sense, spend that time with the patient, but then you get someone on your back about something else that has to be done.
Yeah, I don't want to preach, sabotage or anything like that, but just because it's somebody else's priority doesn't mean it has to be yours.
Right.
And we have a global nursing shortage, so it's really hard to fire a good nurse because you're not going to be able to replace that warm body anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think that you actually have maybe a certain amount of power that you don't recognize in terms of being selective about whether you decide that needs to be your priority.
Yeah.
And I know you'll get nagged, but again, that's where going away for 5 minutes and deep breathing and getting rid of that sticky note comes in.
Yeah, well, I've stood up for myself, but, you know, you're constantly in that situation where you're stonewalling the criticism and you know, you're not going to change my practice. I'll just leave if I have to.
And you're not going to get praise from that source. And once you realize that and stop looking for it, it'll get easier.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just not a good fit for you. You know, there's people who have what it takes to do ambulatory care. And it's not like I'm criticizing you. I'm just saying this may not be a happy fit.
Yeah. The thing is, I love it. I love nursing. I can't ever see myself quitting. But
as I said, we have a nursing shortage. So maybe what you need to do for yourself is sit down with a jobs counselor and identify for yourself what are the aspects of nursing that you really enjoy and problem solve about where to be sending your resume. For example, maybe you want to be talking to the hospice people. Maybe you want to be doing visiting nursing. There's so many opportunities for nurses out there, and we have such a shortage. Write up a resume. Think about where would you like to work? What would your ideal job look like as a nurse? And then,
not in this country, probably.
Well, you know, maybe not. But in any event, it doesn't hurt to do the exercise.
Yeah, but I think, you know, taking that 5 minutes, you know, a couple times a day, you know, that's not too much time to
no.
ask for myself.
It isn't. And if anybody hassles you, you can just tell them that you have a prostate problem and deal with it.
That's good.
Okay. Ciao.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. I hope I helped some. Bye-bye.
Right.
Let's go to Lori in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, actually.
That's good.
But I'm kind of at a interesting position in my, I have rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
And my rheumatologist, Dr. Barber, who I loved, retired. And I've been about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half without a rheumatologist and recently saw somebody. And I got really shaken up because he was saying that, you know, I'm the kind of case that he worries about because I've been minimizing my pain. And it just hasn't seemed like it's been, you know, all that different for me from how I was doing with Dr. Barber. Anyway, I'm just kind of curious about, you know, like when I first was diagnosed with RA, I had really extreme symptoms and was, I mean, you know, like waking up in the morning and not being able to open the bottle with the pills that I used.
Exactly, exactly, because your hands hurt so much.
Yeah,
so stiff.
Yeah.
And so right now, let me ask, first of all, are you on any DMARDs, disease-modifying agents?
I'm on Plaquenil and Nabematon, an SAID.
Okay, so Plaquenil and an NSAID, and how long are you stiff and or swollen in the morning?
It's not a morning thing. It actually hasn't been that way for a long time.
Okay,
it's just
very good.
But I'm a potter. I love to cook. So my thumb, it's like just kind of chronic that my thumb is a little bit swollen, and I deal with it. It doesn't really bother me that much.
How old are you?
I'm 47.
Okay, so...
And I do the fish oil like crazy.
Good.
Yeah.
One of the things that I always urge rheumatoid arthritis patients to try, and I would say maybe one out of five it actually makes a difference, is try eliminating the nightshade vegetables, which are your peppers, eggplant, tomato, You can look that up
yeah,
to get the full list. But you basically stay off of those for 3-4 weeks and monitor your symptoms.
Yeah.
And then eat a bunch of them and see if you flare.
Yeah, I have done that, and I don't know. It's just like...
You're not one of the one out of five.
I don't think so.
That's cool. I just say, I have people try
but
that.
But I'm also not, I'm not very consistent about it, frankly. Yeah. The peppers is the hardest.
I know. But it's, you do it for a month. You can do anything for a month. Believe me. Wisest words I ever got when I was a medical student from a wise intern who seemed, so venerable and wise at that time, because that's how naive I was. Anyway, he said, you can put up with anything for 4 weeks. But it is true. Now, you're not that sick. You're obviously not that sick. Don't let somebody else freak you out because they're worried that the standard of care in medicine has shifted to that everybody has to be on a monoclonal antibody or they'll get sued.
Yeah. I mean, what you were talking about earlier just really rang true for me. I mean, he's like, you should go on Enbrel, which, only costs $15,000 a year.
Well, not only that, but it's not safe. Enbrel is not a safe drug. It's way better than being crippled by rheumatoid arthritis, which is why it got approved by the FDA. But for someone like yourself who's annoyed by their thumb when they cook, we are not talking a level of inflammation and disease in your body that requires the use of a drug which may potentially impair the immune system to the point of allowing cancers to occur, which is exactly what we know about these drugs. Lymphoma. There's a little bit more lymphoma and leukemia in people who use these. Not much, just a few percentage points. Statistically, it's a couple percentage points. Of course, if you're the person who gets lymphoma that they wouldn't have gotten except that they took Enbrel, then you want to really have needed the Enbrel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really need the Enbrel, if you've got a quality of life issue and you're miserable, then bring it on. It's a miracle. It's fabulous. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it, but you've got to do the risk-benefit calculus.
Yeah.
And what happens, a rheumatologist, he's got drug reps in there every day, making him feel guilty for not putting everybody on Enbrel. All kinds of emotional manipulation.
Uh-huh.
They can't bribe us anymore, so now they're trying to scare us. They publish these pseudo guidelines. They influenced institutions. These guidelines come out. Like the nurse was saying, you feel safer if you remain within guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you start gaming the guidelines and making doctors feel threatened, fear is a great marketing tool. If you can make people feel threatened if they don't buy your drug or prescribe your drug, and we're in that situation with the statins now, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
You're on the right track.
Well, the way he kind of, did it was looking at, he had me go get x-rays, and then he was looking at it, he's like, there's nothing between your wrist bones, which is funny because I haven't really had.
Well, you're not all that symptomatic, so I would say you got to go, but I would say you're doing fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Dr. Dawn. I'm coming to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. So long and stay healthy.